You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
G'day, chaps. Where are you?
Where are you, Daniel?
I'm in Berlin.
Sounds like you're in a cafe or something, are you?
I'm in a cafe, yeah. I'm in some hipster joint of dubious repute. Anyway, what about you, Napalm? Living room? Dining room? Bedroom?
In my office. Not living the dream, you know, jet-setting around.
Living the nightmare.
Setting up bases all over Europe.
Anyway, we're mid-Olympics. We're on the eve of the Vuelta, and we announced yesterday that we were covering the Vuelta with daily shows for the first time, so we'll give you a bit more information about that later on. But first, Lionel, can you give us a little news roundup, please?
A very little news roundup this week. The Olympic Games has dominated everything in the cycling world, really, but there has been action elsewhere. Sky's Gianni Moscon won the Arctic race. Looked beautiful, actually, the Arctic race, as it always does. Daniel, you were there a couple of years ago, weren't you? But the scenery, probably the most stunning race of the year. The other good bit of news from there was John Degenkolb won a stage, and that's his first win since that awful crash in training at the start of the year when a car hit the giant Alpecin team while they were in Spain. Diego Ulissi won the Czech Tour ahead of Sebastian Langeveld, and David Rebellin, who's just celebrated his 45th birthday and 8 years ago was winning an Olympic silver medal in the road race, which he held on to fleetingly before the anti-doping authorities got in the way and took it back. A little bit of transfer news I think we'll talk about later on in the episode, but the big transfer is Philippe Gilbert is leaving BMC to join Etix Quickstep. And as you said, Rich, the Vuelta is on the horizon, very close now, only a few days away. And the lineup is pretty strong, isn't it? Chris Froome will lead Sky, as we expected he would. Fabio Aru of Astana won't be defending his title, but the GC riders who will be there include Esteban Chavez, who almost won the Giro. He'll be leading Orica Bike Exchange. Another one of the stars of the Giro, Steven Kruiswijk, will be there, as will Alberto Contador, Nairo Quintana and Alejandro Valverde, who's starting the third and final Grand Tour of the season to complete the set.
It's a great field, isn't it? But we'll get on to the Vuelta and the transfer news, as you said, but there's been a lot of talking points at the Olympic Games, haven't there? I mean, even Daniel, you must have been swept up in the Olympic excitement, have you?
Oh, yeah, I've been gripped. I've been on the edge of my seat. No. It really has. It's just interesting to see how much the Olympic Games have resonated and how they've really sort of captured people's attention and imagination, and just the amount of eyeballs on it, really.
They always do, don't they? They always do. No matter how sort of low-key the build-up seems, when the Olympic Games themselves start, they really dominate and take over. And, you know, I was watching, I'm sure you were too, Lionel, the Keirin last night, which, you know, there were farcical scenes in the Keirin. There were two false starts, and that held up the 10 o'clock news for about an hour and a half. Jason Kenny eventually won that, but and then it was the sort of main story on the news. It's quite incredible. And I was just thinking about the coverage is interesting. There's been a lot of talk about the type of coverage, and I'm sure in Germany, Daniel, you can maybe tell us a bit about this, that the coverage is very much focused on the German athletes. I at the start of the Olympic Games, I was in Utah, of course, at Tour of Utah, and I watched the NBC coverage, and of course, absolutely dominated by the American athletes. And in Great Britain, the coverage is dominated by, and to a large extent, cheering on the British athletes. But you know, you watch that, and there must have been probably 10 million people or so watching the track racing last night, where if that had been, say, a World Cup or a World Championship, the TV audience might have been 100, 200,000.
It's an interesting subject, the Olympics and patriotism, and the sort of outlet it gives for patriotism. And I think, you know, you always hear that, the Brits are more patriotic or jingoistic or chauvinistic than other nations. But I really think that it's a universal kind of human instinct that you see in every country. And it's very much the same in Germany. The focus is almost solely on the German athletes. And I think it's quite difficult for the media, well, particularly the host broadcaster, the rights holder to position itself in terms of how to pitch the coverage, because you know, it jars with me. Rich, you and I have had a a very heated debate, I remember, in a podcast about 4 or 5 years ago about patriotism. I'm not particularly patriotic for various reasons, but I understand why the rights holder has to fulfill that appetite. A lot of people are patriotic, most people are patriotic, and as I said, the Olympics, it provides almost a unique vehicle to capture that and sort of pander to that or play to that. Journalistically, it doesn't sit particularly well a lot of the time, does it? And I think a lot of the coverage often is one-eyed without intending to be one-eyed, but I think it does often come across that way.
It does jar and it does grate, but I think you've got to keep in mind that the vast bulk of the audience, 99% of the audience, are you know, casual watchers of that particular sport, and they're watching it probably purely in order to show some of the home team, the home boys and girls get on.
I think, Rich, you just to put into context your comment about the BBC delaying the 10 o'clock news, I mean, that is almost unheard of, certainly to delay the 10 o'clock news for almost an hour and a half. The 10 o'clock news is almost sort of the bedrock of the TV schedule. It doesn't move for anything, really. And I think that sets into context the importance of the Olympic Games to the BBC and the importance of British success. I mean, they wouldn't have held off the 10 o'clock news had it been too foreign. Foreign riders going for gold medals, let's face it. And I think the only thing I would say about the style of the BBC's coverage, or the general coverage really, is the failure to kind of put into context that, and this is something Daniel's mentioned a lot, that Great Britain absolutely outspend every other nation in terms of track cycling. And whereas road events are much harder to control, much harder to just pump money in and expect results out, the track events are, it's possible to kind of, you know, build an entire program, fund an entire program around peaking for the Olympic Games every 4 years. And one of the themes of the championships has been, you know, the failure of the Australians to repeat their success from World Championships in the last 2-3 years. And really, they've got it wrong in terms of timing, in terms of prioritising the Olympic Games. And the one thing you can say about the Great Britain squad is that everything has built towards this week over the last 4 years. And cycling is the second best funded of the Olympic sports in Britain. Rowing gets £32 million per Olympic cycle. That's a four-year cycle. Cycling gets £30 million. And when you look at the medal table at the moment, if you take into account Chris Froome's medal in the time trial as well, we've got 12 medals for those £30 million. I say Great Britain, have got 12 medals for £30 million. I can't help being British, where I was born. But that puts the cost of an Olympic medal at £2.5 million. And, you know, you look at the cost of that investment, that's a significant spend. You know, that's what it takes. And when people say, well, how come Great Britain are so dominant? They're dominant because they have the money. They've been able to develop athletes from young ages. They've been able to identify athletes from other sports. Katie Marchant's a good example. She was an athlete, a heptathlete, I think. And, you know, she was drawn into cycling. You know, cycling now has sort of tentacles everywhere in Britain. And having an Olympic Games like this will, you know, only attract more people to it and strengthen their position. And the sort of unspoken truth, I suppose, is that until a nation comes along and kind of matches that spending, matches that desire to focus on the Olympic Games above everything else, they may well find themselves relatively unchallenged.
I would bet that there'll be other, maybe a majority of other track programmes at the Olympic Games with budgets of less than £2.5 million, i.e. less than it costs for a single medal from the British perspective. I mean, there was the women's team pursuit final was interesting, America against GB, and you watch that and always think of Great Britain as being underdogs against the US, but in reality the US has one paid staff member, and that is Andy Sparks. He's the only sort of full-time member of the coaching staff, whereas Great Britain have 30-40 staff. You know, it's a huge difference.
And the same applies, Richard, to Italy. I mean, Italy's a country with a great cycling heritage, you know, fantastic history in the sport. But until about 5 years ago, Italy, well, hadn't had a covered velodrome. And now it has one. And just that, the existence of that one covered velodrome in Monte Chiari near Brescia, it played a massive role in getting Elia Viviani to where he got and to gold medal position in the Omnium. But besides that, he has almost had to do it entirely on his own or with the help of a few kind of, not volunteers, but people who have really been treated the track as their passion project. And there isn't an awful lot of funding behind them. And in Viviani's case, he's also had to rely an awful lot on the British system, to be honest. I mean, half of his gold medal is, or 25% of his gold medal owes really to some of the know-how and savoir-faire, and who knows what else he's picked up at Team Sky since he's been there for the last 2 years on the road.
Well, let's talk about the racing, shall we? I mean, shall we start with the Omnium, which Viviani won? I mean, Viviani... you know, terrific. It was great to see actually some of the world's best road sprinters gather. You know, Fernando Gaviria was there as well. And it made me think, you know, wonder if Marcel Kittel might have a go at that at some point. Why not? You know, it'd be great to see it become an event that some of the top road sprinters had a go at. But Viviani was a very worthy, very deserving winner. He was flying at the start of this season. He then sort of went off the boil a bit at the Giro, didn't finish the Giro, he was eliminated at the Giro. One of the stories I liked about Viviani at the Giro was that when he was eliminated from the race, he sent text messages to all his Team Sky teammates and staff, a different text message to everyone, very heartfelt, apologetic message for not being able to finish the Giro. He's a guy that people speak of very highly, very warmly, and I think a lot of people very happy to see him win that gold medal.
I would agree, Rich. I'm not sure Mark Cavendish was getting on particularly well with him at the start of the year. There was a bit of an incident, wasn't there? Was it at Tirreno Adriatico? And I know that dragged on. That dragged on for a while. I don't think they were on speaking terms for a few months, but it was interesting that Cavendish was quite magnanimous, wasn't he, having won the silver medal, and he, the much debated, much talked about crash, did Cavendish cause it? Did he cause it deliberately? One thing is certain, he actually apologised to Viviani, which I was quite...
He certainly caused it. I think the issue was, and I weighed in on Twitter, which I regretted, because it's very dangerous to express an opinion on Twitter, but he caused the crash. The issue was it malicious, i.e. was it deliberate? And I don't believe any rider would deliberately crash, because for one thing, he's worked, you know, for a year to get himself into shape for this Omnium. He spent most of the winter in Manchester training the track. Why on earth would he risk all that to crash, and for what? And you know, it was if you watch the footage, he looked back, he saw the rider, you would imagine he saw the rider, the banking is very steep and the perspective can be odd. He saw the rider, he dropped down the track, which people do throughout the points race or any bunch race, and Park behind him, Sang-hoon Park, glanced back at the same time and drifted up the track and they collided. I think had Park kept looking ahead, he would have adjusted his line accordingly and fallen in behind Cavendish, as happens many, many times during the race. And I couldn't believe that people were suggesting that Cavendish did it deliberately.
Yeah, when you see a bunch race on the track, whether it's a six-day event like the Ghent Six or a Madison or a points race or even a scratch race, these kind of sudden moves down the banking are part of the racing, because the riders use the banking to generate a little bit of speed. And the great skill of track racing is that when the rider above you on the track makes a downward movement towards you, then the rider in the lower position also adjusts, and I mean, it's no exaggeration really to say that the riders have almost got eyes in the back of their heads when racing on the track. But these kind of things, you know, there are incidents like this in every single bunch race on the track, you know, that very near misses, and this wasn't a near miss. Obviously Cavendish careered straight into the Korean rider, but it wasn't a particularly smart move, it wasn't a particularly safe move, obviously, because the Korean rider ended up in quite a bit of difficulty. The idea that you could knock somebody off in order to win, almost sort of wacky racist style, I mean, just unthinkable to me. I mean, no elite rider would do that, because the consequences are so severe. You just don't know, or the potential consequences are so severe. A touch of wheels can cause a puncture in on a track bike quite easily. So I think the idea that it would be a deliberate move is I would have to rule that out. However, had the commissaires taken a very dim view and disqualified Mark Cavendish for that and said, sorry mate, that's dangerous riding, I think he would have struggled to have had much of a case to argue against that, and so he was a lucky boy, really.
And Lionel, Mark Cavendish, as has often been the case, did not do himself too many favours by allegedly telling a Dutch reporter that he could sue him for asking questions about the crash and who caused the crash. But, you know, I think...
No, well, that's standard, isn't it? I mean, Cavendish often behaves badly in those situations, but that's separate to the incident itself. You know, that's a separate incident. That doesn't have any relation to whether or not the crash was malicious. And I, as Lionel says, I don't believe that a rider would do that deliberately.
It is separate to it, but it's also the kind of behaviour which makes people more inclined to blame Cavendish for incidents like that. I mentioned earlier, I suggested that the little bit of friction there was between Cavendish and Viviani flared at Tirreno Adriatico. It was actually caused at the Worlds, wasn't it? At the World Omnium Championship earlier this year, where Cavendish effectively denied Viviani the gold medal. So you could say some justice has been done. Cavendish denied Viviani the gold medal, I think, by out sprinting. Was it for sprinting for fourth place or in the points race? Something along those lines. And the domino effect of that was Viviani not winning the gold.
Anyway, Cavendish's investment in the track, I think, has paid off. I think he'll be, when he reflects on it, quite pleased with that silver medal. He certainly looked in a completely different shape. He looked like a different rider to the rider who struggled around the Omnium in at the World Championships in London, where I watched him and just thought, absolutely no chance will he get a medal in Rio. So he's a rider who obviously goes better with a lot of racing in his legs, as he has now. But I think also the work he did on the track over the winter, that base has paid off in the end. What about the rumoured spat between him and Bradley Wiggins? He went out and rode a world class pursuit, a time that would have won him a silver medal at the Beijing Olympics, when the individual pursuit was still an event there behind Wiggins, and he was wanting Wiggins' Olympic record, wasn't he, to make a point that he could have ridden in the team pursuit.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I described it to someone on Twitter, they asked how big was the beef, and I said it was barely a slice of carpaccio brezzaola. It wasn't serious beef. It wasn't a bistecca fiorentina or anything like that. However, there were...
Glad you clarified that.
Yeah, I think... No, I think it was fairly minor. But, again, this I think, brought out another of characters. Cavendish's traits that, you know, we've talked about a lot over the years. This kind of, not a persecution complex, but this desire to prove people wrong at all costs, which I think has been key to his success this year. And it's been absolutely key to his success on the track, that people really doubted him in the way that they doubted him at the start of his professional career when he came onto the road and they said, you haven't got the body to be a professional cyclist. And he said, well, screw you, I'm going to show you. And I think he lost a lot of that. And I think this year, by virtue of riding a lot on the track, he's got that back. And I think this minor incident with the pursuit illustrates that perfectly. You tell Cavendish that he can't do something, and the majority of the time he's going to do his damnedest to prove you wrong. And, you know, as you say, Richard, the pursuit he rode in the Omnium really bears that out, doesn't it?
Just a last word on the Omnium before we move on to some of the other events, and Viviani's consistency. I mean, it is an event that rewards consistency. If you look at in the final analysis, Lassie Norman Hansen, the Danish rider who won the Omnium 4 years ago in London, got off to a flying start. He won the first two events. But then the third event of the first day, which was the elimination race, he was really caught napping right at the start, possibly a consequence of having gone last in the individual pursuit round. So he had among the least rest between events, and Hansen got off to a terrible start and was, I think, first rider eliminated. In fact, he was first rider eliminated, which was a real surprise, and that put him on the back foot and meant he ended up with only a bronze medal. Had he even finished sort of middle of the pack, he probably would have won the gold medal again. And likewise, it was a minor slip by Cavendish in that elimination race, where he was boxed in a bit on the inside and went off on the left hand side off the track and went up the inside, which you're not allowed to do, and he was out earlier than you might have expected. And Viviani put the seal on it really by just being the most consistent, and he just seemed to have a kind of, you know, everything aligned for him, didn't it? He was even the crash where he crashed into the back of the Korean rider who Mark Cavendish had collided with. You know, even that didn't cause him too much difficulty. He was really calm. He got a replacement bike. He got back into the race and just kept an eye on everybody. It was a really sort of masterful performance by Viviani, I thought.
Shall we, before we sort of wrap up the Olympics, we don't want to go through every event like this because that could take a while, but a few worth mentioning. I mean, Laura Trott won the women's Omnium, made it look, you know, having watched the men's Omnium, you realise what a complicated event it is, especially when it all comes down to the points race and the race is still up for grabs. It's incredibly complicated, and I don't know how the riders kind of keep track of what's going on. But Laura Trott was a really dominant winner of the women's Omnium again. She makes winning a complicated event look really easy. That's her fourth Olympic gold medal. She's still only 24. She's an amazing athlete, an amazing racer, and always great to watch her race. Must try and get an interview with her for the Cycling Podcast Femina at some point, I think. That would be good. And then the track programme kind of finished off with the Kieran, and I mentioned the farcical scenes. It was restarted twice when the Durney, the motor pacer, pulled off and the riders overtook its back wheel. Now, we were chatting between us just before we started recording earlier about they were using an electric bike, and it looked a bit ridiculous anyway. And to my mind, the pacer normally sort of accelerates as he comes off the track, as he peels off the track. This bike seemed to slow down, which also made it more likely that the riders coming behind would overtake him. And I don't know if that's the conclusion that the UCI officials came to, who didn't take any action despite having stopped the race. Nobody was disqualified, nobody was penalised. All six riders were allowed to restart both times, so it was a complete farce, a complete waste of time, a real embarrassment at you know, an Olympic Games for the final event of the track programme to be delayed like that, with, as I say, no consequences. I don't know what your take on it was, Lionel.
Well, I mean, it's not the eco-friendly answer to say bring back the noisy, dirty, diesely motorbikes, but the Kieran events just miss so much with these silent electric bikes. It's the result of they were introduced in the Track World Cup in London in, when would that have been now, December 2014, and they trialled them there. There was some kind of deal between the UCI and the makers of these electric bikes to, you know, basically provide, you know, to make them, you know, so that there's not a load of petrol fumes spewing out into an enclosed velodrome, I assume. But there's no noise either. So, as I say, the atmosphere is lessened somewhat. And these electric Durney bikes have been used in Track World Cups and the World Championships since the start of 2015. And, you know, I can only assume that's part of, you know, the Olympics obviously carrying on having the same system. But whether it's to do with the bike or whether it's to do with the Durney rider, the issue was, as you said when we were chatting beforehand, Rich, that the bike didn't pull off the track at the same speed. It seemed to be slowing down before it was actually off the track. You know, obviously difficult to definitely say that as an actual fact, because obviously the riders will start accelerating as soon as they see the opportunity to do so, because once they're up at speed, they want to maintain and increase that speed. They don't want to have to, you know, slow down and wait while the guy pulls off, you know, as if, you know, a sort of rather doddery driver is pulling onto the hard shoulder. It just didn't look like the Durney rider knew exactly what he should be doing, which is basically carry on at the same speed and get off the track kind of as quickly as possible and leave the riders to it. It was almost like a sort of an invisible rein holding everybody in.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Their coverage continues, of course. The home of cycling is showing the Women's World Tour, the latest event in the Women's World Tour this Sunday. That's the Crescent Vargarda team time trial, and it's live on Eurosport 1 between 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. on Sunday, with Rob Hatch in the commentary box. And also, of course, the Vuelta begins on Saturday, and that will be live on Eurosport throughout the 3 weeks of the third Grand Tour of the season, and we'll be covering that as well. And we're looking forward to that. Have we got anything else to wrap up from the From the track at the Olympic Games. Daniel, I heard you ordering a flat white there, I think.
No, you did not. Enough nonsense. Come on.
Cappuccino? Cappuccino?
No, no.
Anything else? Any other business from the Olympic Games before we move on to the Vuelta?
Just to a bit of balance. Don't want to sound too harsh on Great Britain and say it's all down to the money, because it's obviously not. It's down to all of the infrastructure and expertise and time that money buys, really. But they did dominate 6 of the 10 gold medals on the track. And they got it. They got pretty much everything right. World records in both the men's and women's team pursuits, an Olympic record in the team sprint, which, you know, if you'd said even 6 months ago that Philip Hines, Jason Kenny and Callum Skinner would win the team sprint in such a sort of dominant fashion, that just certainly didn't look on the cards. The other performances that caught the eye, obviously Becky James, after the very difficult few years she's had, to come out with a couple of silver medals. But Christina Vogel as well, you know, really impressive through the latter rounds of the sprint. The German rider who won the team sprint, I think, in 2012, that would have been, where the Chinese were disqualified, weren't they, in the final, and the German pair, Vogel and Miriam Welter, got gold in that. And Vogel won the individual sprint. And as she crossed the line in the second race of her 2-0 win over Becky James, her saddle basically collapsed under her and fell off her bike. And it really was quite a remarkable feat to save save herself and not come to grief there. That was pretty impressive. And finally, just on a personal point, I was really happy to see Azil Hasni Awang win a bronze medal for Malaysia in the Keirin. Always a very entertaining rider, famous for his kind of wheelies over the line when he wins a race. You know, he's animated a lot of track World Cups and World Championships over the years, and particularly having been in Manchester a few years ago when he got that huge splinter through his calf, which was, extremely painful. Got an 8-inch splinter through his leg. It was great to see Malaysia and Awang and his rather flamboyant coach, have a real moment of glory.
It was great to see Awang. He really enjoyed that medal, and it's lovely to see somebody. Actually, the whole podium in the Keirin were all very happy, and that was great to see. And Awang has been around for years and years and years, and it's a great reward for him. He is, as you say, a very exciting rider, and he was lucky, along with Jason Kenny, perhaps, after that first heat, not to perhaps be disqualified for overtaking the Derny. So a bit of relief as well for him. Just a very final point on the money aspect, I think. I mean, what it's allowed Great Britain to buy, and it's not just the cycling team. We see, you know, Great Britain as a whole is having an incredible Olympic Games. Robert Harris, the author, wrote a tweet the other day saying that he imagines this is what it was like living in East Germany in the 1970s, which has sort of certain connotations, and some people will be quite uncomfortable with the level of success and wondering how it's been achieved.
Well, plenty of people would argue, Richard, that the whole lottery funding system is it's certainly not based on exactly the same premise as the East German system, but there are similar kind of goals, and this is certainly not unique to the UK funding system, but similar goals of kind of maybe not political advancement, but certainly advancing the idea of a nation. I imagine you guys can fill me in on this, but I imagine there have been various articles in the UK and people talking about the kind of sociological impact and the time at which this success has arrived for Great Britain. It obviously is a time with the Brexit vote and political crisis. It's a time when British self-esteem has taken a bit of a knock, and I suppose some of the kind of what we have referred to as chauvinism or jingoism or just outpouring of patriotic fervour has maybe been exaggerated by the fact that Great Britain as a nation and British people feel a little bit sort of beleaguered at the moment.
Yeah, I haven't seen too many articles along those lines, Daniel, but if any commissioning editors are listening, it sounds like Daniel is your man to do that. Can I just make the point I was wanting to make about the money and what the money has actually bought? Because we obviously see the athletes. What we don't see is all the people behind the scenes, and Dave Brailsford has often talked about the lottery having created an industry in sports scientists and performance analysts and nutritionists, physiologists, all these ologists and scientists who are very qualified people and from all over the world work in British sport and transfer between different sports. And these are the people, it seems to me, who are largely responsible for getting the athletes in the kind of shape, in the kind of condition, in the kind of form to win at the Olympic Games. And, you know, well, it's almost, you know, there's a system there. There's a system. For one country to have produced just so many gold medal winning athletes is not just about having talented athletes. There's a system there that's producing these people. And I think that those scientists, all these people I mentioned earlier behind the scenes, are that's what where the lottery money is going, and that's what's being achieved with it.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really got time to explore the sort of wider social aspects of the role that sport plays in a nation or role that sport plays in Great Britain. But, you know, in a period of time where, you know, one of the biggest challenges for young people is finding space is to play sport and participate in things, it's... you know, something about the fact that, you know, rowing and cycling, which are quite expensive sports to participate in, really, in the grand scheme of things. It's not as cheap as just putting on a pair of running shoes or just getting a ball and kicking it around. You know, a lot of youngsters are being drawn towards cycling, which is fantastic for cycling. And the participation aspect is something that British cycling has been really quite good at since Beijing, really, when they have managed to capitalise on the success at the top. And yes, it's not a phrase I particularly like, but there has been a trickle-down effect. And, you know, I see sometimes comments on Twitter about, you know, sort of middle-aged men racing through the lanes thinking they're Jason Kenny. But, you know, why not? You know, if people have got a bit of a paunch to work off, and I'm not just talking about myself here, but, you know, why not get a bike? It doesn't have to be an expensive hobby to pursue.
And let's not underestimate the value of role models. You know, there's a nice picture circulating on the internet of a young 12-year-old Laura Trott with Bradley Wiggins and his first Olympic gold medal. I think it was after Athens. Callum Skinner was 12 years old. In fact, it was his birthday on the day that Chris Hoy won his gold medal in Athens. And that directly inspired him to go to his nearest velodrome the next day and take up track cycling. These are individual cases, but they're very powerful stories.
Well, yeah, they are powerful stories, but I'm not sure they're worth £32 million. But anyway.
I wouldn't disagree with that. Shall we move on to the Vuelta? We're covering the Vuelta with daily shows for the first time. We're doing it in a slightly different way to the previous two Grand Tours that we've covered this year. We're not going to be on the ground for the whole of it. You will be there for the whole of it, Daniel.
Till the bitter
Lionel
end.
And yeah. Lionel and I will float in and float out. I'm going for the sort of towards the end of the first week until the end of the second week, and Lionel will take over for the final week.
Yeah, it very, very much wasn't on the race programme at the start of the year, was it? We're like a, you know, we've had
TJ Van Garder in a podcast,
Giro,
aren't we?
Well, I think we had a decent Giro, Mikel and a decent tour, and the opportunity to complete the set. We're more Marino Lacharetta or Adam Hansen.
Alejandro Valverde. Well,
Alejandro Valverde, yeah, keep the set, you know, collect the set.
But we're looking forward to it, aren't we?
Yeah, I certainly am. I mean, I've been a bit, I've been picked up on my antipathy towards the Vuelta in the past. You know, for a long time I did think that it might have been better had it been cut to a fortnight rather than, you know, does the World Tour need three-week Grand Tours? But I think the most recent editions of the race in terms of the actual competition between the riders and the names that turn up on the start line, the Vuelta has kind of trumped the other two year after year, really.
Yeah, and I think the arrival of ASO to ASO kind of helped the Vuelta out of trouble. I forget exactly which year it was, but has been a massive fillip for the race because they've taught the Vuelta, or they've helped the Vuelta, an awful lot in terms of TV production and how to make the race more attractive. We've talked before on the podcast about the routes, the Vuelta routes, Fernando Escartín and Javier Guillén, the race director, have done a lot of work on making the race look more attractive and taking it to, you know, very, very picturesque places that really show off Spain in its best light. And that has certainly enhanced the TV viewers' experience a great deal.
Well, we'll convene on Saturday for the first show after the team time trial. So that should go out late Saturday evening, I guess. And Maybe in keeping with the Spanish theme, we will be putting out the shows sometimes quite late due to logistical things in the evening, but they'll certainly be available in your feed first thing the next morning, won't they?
They will indeed, yeah. I think, Daniel, yeah, that's a really key point, and one that perhaps TV viewers don't realise is important to them at the time. I mean, I remember sort of the early part of the 2000s, you know, when the Vuelta was still really settling into this late summer slot. Until the mid-90s, it was held in the spring before the Giro kind of overlapped with the Amstel Gold Race, and it, you know, it was a race which had a very different character. And then when it moved to this late summer spot, certainly in the sort of doldrum-ish years of the early 2000s, it was just a very brown race. It was, you know, a lot of the countryside, they went through sort of flat plains, it seemed, day after day, and obviously very, very warm in Spain in the summer, and it just didn't look like it was showing the best of Spain. And there are examples where time trials were held on dual carriageways with only traffic cones separating the outward leg from the inward leg, and it just didn't look like a sporting event that deserved to be on a national sort of platform, let alone an international one. And ASO, you're right, has really sort of reversed that, and have, it's probably no accident that the opening week or so is going to be up right up in the north, where it is very picturesque. And although I'll miss that bit, I'm certainly looking forward to the last week, when we anticipate a very close finish with that final mountain stage on the last Saturday.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Yes, thank you very much to our sponsor, Rafa, who are enabling us to go and cover the Vuelta. Of course, their sponsorship helps us to do that, as does your friends' support, all the friends of the podcast, people who signed up through thecyclingpodcast.com. As friends, very much appreciated. Our next friend special on Alberto Contador is coming up soon. It will be released at some point early in the Vuelta, so stay tuned for that. And on Rafa, I'm taking part in an event this week at the Rafa Cycle Club in Soho in London with a certain Bradley Wiggins, who will just be fresh off the plane from Rio. That will be recorded and released as a podcast, my conversation with Bradley Wiggins in front of an audience in Soho. That'll be coming out soon. Also coming out soon will be a chat I had in the other Rafa Cycle Club in Spitalfields in London with Joe Dombrowski, who is riding the Vuelta, and that will be released also in the next week or so. Stay tuned for that. Thanks very much to Rafa again for their sponsorship and for their organisation of those events. So we're gonna talk a bit of transfer gossip in a moment, but Daniel, you wanted to return to the Vuelta, and you've got a prediction, I think.
No, not a prediction. I mean, I said there are a few things I'm curious about, particularly curious about the Vuelta. One of them is what Chris Froome's goals, objectives are for the Vuelta. He doesn't seem to me to be the kind of rider who is desperate to kind of collect scalps, collect milestones, and really build a palmarès that puts him in a certain place in cycling history. That doesn't really seem to be a major preoccupation of his. However, I'm sure he would love to add a Vuelta. It would kind of enhance his standing in the pantheon of cycling, certainly in the current generation. But, you know, there was obviously a lot of talk during the Tour de France about how strong his team was and how much of the credit was theirs, really. I noticed Manolo Saiz, the disgraced former Once team manager after the Olympic time trial, he tweeted something to the effect of Froome is a strong rider, but his team is what's exceptionally strong and what has allowed him to win three Tours de France. And the team that Sky are taking to the Vuelta is a bit of a hodgepodge of riders who haven't done a lot of racing this year and certainly haven't ridden a lot with Froome in the past. People like
the vanity signing.
The team is Boswell, Froome, Goyash, Kenya, Knees, Koenig, Kwiatkowski, Landa and Pucho. So it's a strong team, but it's not a sort of team that's been moulded and tailor-made for Froome. So I'm curious about that. There's certainly there are a couple of very explosive climbs at the Vuelta to finish stages. The stage finishing at Peña Carparga On stage 11, I think it's Peña Carbarga, will remind people, will certainly bring back memories of Froome's big breakthrough as a Grand Tour rider, his big battle with Juan José Cobo on the same summit finish in 2011. Froome won the stage, but Cobo won the war. He won the Vuelta. So that will be very interesting. And I'm also curious to see Esteban Chávez at Orica Bike Exchange. He obviously rode a very fine Giro d'Italia, was in the pink jersey on the penultimate day, lost it to Vincenzo Nibali, and that is a team that has really made a big punt, or is making a big gamble in the way that it's going to structure its team from now on. They've really decided to go down the general classification route by re-signing the Yates twins this week. And Adam Yates was obviously fantastic in the Tour de France general classification, and they're putting a lot of support behind Esteban Chávez. And there are some doubts about whether Chávez is going to be a Grand Tour winner at any point in the future. He's certainly going to be a very fine Grand Tour rider, but you know whether he has quite the engine to go up against guys like Froome and Quintana is a little bit of a moot point. But I think it's a great opportunity for him to prove his pedigree. And Simon Yates, who obviously served his doping ban in the spring, or well, fairly contentious doping ban, he's coming back, and it's going to be an interesting testing ground for him as well, isn't it?
I think he'll go well, actually, especially after watching his brother finish fourth at the Tour. On Froome, I think if he's in a position to win the Vuelta, he'll certainly try and win it. But I think he looks in the Vuelta almost as the first block of training for the following year's Tour. I think when he's looked at his form in previous years, he's seen that he's gone better at the Tour when he's ridden a good Vuelta the year before, this year being an exception because he crashed out last year and broke his foot. But I think the Vuelta is almost part of the pre-season training for Froome, but he'll win it if he's in a position to win it. I think the guy who probably most wants to win it is probably Alberto Contador, no?
Yeah, you know, is this going to be the last hurrah? I think Contador might have one last Grand Tour victory in him. Recent history suggests it's not going to be the Tour de France. He hasn't really been very competitive in the Tour de France since 2010, when he won and subsequently was stripped of the victory. So his best chance probably does come in the Vuelta, or, well, I don't think he's going to ride the Giro d'Italia again. Certainly suggested that he's not going to. So you would think that next year is going to be, you know, a year older, a year closer to the point where he's going to be put out to pasture. So I think this is maybe his last chance. And also Quintana is going to be interesting. His stock has fallen after the Tour de France, there's no doubt about that. He finished third but never really looked close to threatening Froome, so he's got a bit of a point to prove as well. So lots of interest there, and I'm sure there'll be some dark horses, some new names, or people that haven't really we haven't really considered as Grand Tour contenders will come to the fore. And also very interesting to see Hugh Carthy at Caja Rural, who has been running extremely well over the last couple of years for that Pro Continental team, and has signed for Cannondale Drapac next year. And there's a lot of excitement about him. Is he Froome's natural heir in terms of British Grand Tour riders? We don't know. We might find out at the Vuelta.
Transfer news. You mentioned Lionel, the big one, Philip Gilbert to Etix Quickstep, and he signed for 1 year. And you know, I was talking to Daniel before we started recording about it. Seems increasingly likely, as Patrick Lefebvre told us in the podcast, that Etix Quickstep may come to an end at the end of 2017. Brian Holm sort of hinted as much during the Tour as well, that he might stop working in cycling and go into a career full time in politics if the team folds. It seems a very real possibility that Etix Quickstep may fold at the end of 2017, which would leave a huge hole, really. It's an institution, a huge Belgian team that may disappear, and the consequences of that are pretty serious, I would have thought.
You would have to think that there will be a replacement in some form. It might not grow from the sort of scaffold or the remnants of Etix Quickstep, but you would think that, you know, we all know what kind of coverage cycling gets, particularly during the classic season in Belgium. We're talking 10, 12 pages in all of the major newspapers. It's on all the sort of main channels, and you would think that a fairly strong economy like Belgium would be able to come up with conjure up some kind of sponsor for a big team. Just on ethics, Richard, I mean, that uncertainty has definitely conditioned their recruitment this year. I mean, they've only really been able to offer people contracts to the end of 2017. And I know that amid all that speculation about Peter Sagan and where he was going to go, Specialized, the bike company, were very involved in that. And ideally, they would have liked Sagan to go to Etix Quickstep, but the uncertainty about the team's future dictated that that wasn't really ever going to be an option. And he's ultimately ended up with Bora, where he's going to be on a Specialized bike.
But Tony Martin is off.
Yeah, they're already losing their pieces, aren't they? Tony Martin's off. He's gone to Katusha, which may seem like an odd move at first glance, but that team is going to have a distinctly German tinge to it next year, because, well, they're still going to be on Canyon bikes. Canyon Bike Company is based in Koblenz in Germany, and I think that was quite a strong motivation for Tony Martin, the prospect of riding on a Canyon time trial bike. He's certainly very excited about that prospect. And a lot of rumours still about Alpecin, the shampoo company, leaving Giant as a co-sponsor and coming on board with Katusha, and they're also a German company. So yeah, as I said, it might be quite Germanic, that team, next year.
Sorry chaps, I was just trying to do a bit of mental arithmetic and work out how many gold medals BMC Racing could have bought had they not spent all that money on Philippe Gilbert.
Quite a few, I would imagine. Just finally on the transfer news, it's just been confirmed that Theo Gegenhardt has joined Team Sky. We knew that, really. I think Etix Quickstep were also in the market for him, but presumably could only offer him 1 year, which I think as a Neo Pro he'd have to be offered 2 years. Is that not correct still, Daniel?
I think it is, although that would not have been the first time that a Neo Pro has signed for a team which only has 1 year remaining on its sponsorship agreement or World Tour licence.
Well, anyway, it's not a great surprise. Gegenhardt rode as a stagiaire for Team Sky last year, and so he's joining Team Sky. And I think one big reason for that is that the Yates brothers. I don't think Team Sky could contemplate losing another hot young British talent, risking him going off to another team. So Theo Gegenhardt will join Sky.
And Hugh Carthy. And I also think that a realisation is setting, not only among the riders themselves, but also at Team Sky, that Team Sky is not the best place for young general classification riders to develop in the first 2, maybe 4, maybe 6 years of their professional careers.
Don't tell Theo that.
Well, yeah. Sorry, Gap Year. Gap Year, of course, as we affectionately have known him, friend of the podcast, fully paid up. He'll certainly be able to afford the subs next year, won't he?
Well, I might have to put it up, maybe a Team Sky rate. Him and Ian Boswell, I think, are our two friends of the podcast at that team. And Boswell's riding the Vuelta, of course, so we'll no doubt see him. I did speak to Theo Gegenhardt at the Tour of Utah, and we will be playing that interview in a package about his team action, the Axel Merckx team, in a future episode after the Vuelta, that will be. Anyway, should we wrap things up there, chaps? That's been a packed old show, and we've got the Vuelta coming up.
We have indeed, yeah. 3 weeks of Grand Tour racing, but particularly looking forward to getting out to Spain. For what can I eat and drink, Daniel? What am I allowed to eat and drink in Spain?
Not really my thing, but are you coming to Galicia, Napalm, first few stages?
No, sadly not.
Yeah, you would have had some nice octopus, that kind of thing there. Where are you arriving?
Do pay attention.
I'm flying into Bilbao and then out of Alicante, so doing that.
Oh, right.
Block,
so you've been the Basque Country.
Basque Country, yeah.
Pinchos, and we'll be spending a bit of time in France, I think, won't we? We'll probably have one night in France. There's a stage finishing to Gourette halfway up the Obisque. Fortunately, won't be venturing back into Andorra, which I know you loved during the Tour de France. Mm.
Well, let's wrap things up there. We have got a busy few weeks ahead of us, and as I mentioned earlier, other things coming out of the Bradley Wiggins chat and Joe Dombrowski. So thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
We'll let you get back to your flat white coffee, and thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, chap. See you in Spain.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.